Good afternoon, and welcome to the South by Southwest panel, Popping Your Bubble, Stories from the Digital Divide. My name is Eric Martin, and I'll be your moderator for the day. The hashtag for the session is DGTLDIV. It's right up there on the slide. Feel free to participate that way. I've encouraged a lot of people that haven't been able to be here today to also follow online, so wonderful way to communicate. We want this session to be an open discussion, so we are going to take questions from the audience throughout. Please just line up behind the mic in the aisle, and we'll take breaks at opportune times to answer questions from the audience in the order that the people lined up. Today's session is being recorded and will be distributed as an audio podcast, as well as a radio program to radio stations serving areas that are on the unconnected side of the digital divide. We will also post either video clips or the entire discussion on YouTube, blip.tv, and Vimeo. So now let's meet the panel. As I said, I'm Eric Martin. I am the Interactive Media Specialist for Native American Public Telecommunications. NAPT is a 35-year-old organization which advances Native media that represents the values, experiences, histories, and cultures of tribal nations, communities, and people. We are one of five members of the National Minority Consortia, bringing color to your color television through documentaries on PBS. The consortia also provide a great deal of diverse public media content online, as can be seen currently in the PBS Online Film Festival. Next, I'd like to introduce on the end Dee Davis. Dee is the president of the Center for Rural Strategies, which seeks to improve economic and social conditions for communities in the countryside and around the world through the better use of media and communications. The center also works to assure the accurate portrayal of, as well as challenge stereotypes of, rural communities. Before founding Rural Strategies, Dee worked for 25 years at Apple Shop, a rural media and arts and culture center. At Apple Shop, he served as executive producer for more than 50 television documentaries on Appalachian culture and social issues. Next to Dee is Allison Aldridge Sauer. She is the director of e-marketing for the Chickasaw Nation's Division of Commerce. Allison has worked in the high-tech industry for over 10 years. As a member of the Chickasaw Nation, she jumped at the chance to leverage digital media to support the tribal business initiatives that fund services for Chickasaw people and Native Americans. I actually met Allison last year at South by Southwest during her great panel, What Digital Tribes Can Learn from Native Americans. Finally, next to me is Dean Davis. By the way, no relation to Dee Davis. They just happen to be two gentlemen that are passionate about bridging the digital divide that have very similar names.
Passionate about Davis.
And Dean is the technology coordinator for the College of Menominee Nation Community Technology Center. Dean is a veteran and a proud member of the Menominee Nation. Before being charged with getting the new Community Technology Center up, Dean was a broadband instructor for the Department of Continuing Education at the College of Menominee Nation and UW Extension. You might have seen him in this role in the video we were playing before the session, Building Community Capacity Through Broadband Training and Outreach. So starting off with Dee, what is the biggest roadblock to people accessing the internet, in your opinion?
It's money. I mean, I think that there's 7 billion people in the world, and 2/3 of them are not online. If you look at this, I mean, those people who are not online are mostly poor and they're mostly rural. And if you look at the United States, we've gone from first in connectivity to the latest numbers, I think, are 18th. And the reason that we're disconnected is because a lot of communities that don't, they're not in the right spot or don't have enough money are being bypassed or redlined or just missing out. So I think that there are questions about training, there are questions about affordability, and when you get right down to it, you see inner city communities of color and you see distant rural communities that are missing out, and when you take another sort, you see that the income levels there are much lower.
Allison, what's your opinion on what's the roadblock?
Well, I'm always concerned that we're going to miss a kind of small definition that around speed. You know, not all broadband is the same. It's not all equal. And I saw a statistic recently that in 17 states, there's a difference of 15% to 25% in the actual speed that you're getting. And I know in my community, there are lots of times when things just kind of get so slow that I give up on the participation part of the participation age, you know, and just close it and walk away. So to me, speed, if you have access, speed means participation. And for the rural communities and some of the communities that are locked out to not only access, but then also really participate in the promise of Web 2.0, they're going to need speed.
Dean, what is your opinion on what the biggest roadblock is?
Well, right now, we just received this broadband cable that was placed in the ground where we live. And so we just got this high-speed internet. One of the things right now that we're doing is trying to get members of the community to to start getting their internet access in their home. So it's more right now for us is the community outreach and the training that we're going through. That's, you know, trying to reach out to other community members. So.
And what are common areas do you see people that you are training having problems with when using the internet? Those sort of, like, I would have never thought of that moment, like we saw in the video.
I think it's the computer language. You know, what is a click? What is a button? How to use the mouse? A lot of members tend to not know what you're talking about. So you have to really take it slow, and it does take a while. So.
Allison, have you talked with your web team about some of the assumptions we make when designing a site, and that people who have never been to a website might not know about, and having not lived through Web 1.0, can you share some of the common assumptions?
Yeah, and I mean, anytime you're looking at conventions, web design conventions, you're talking about something that has emerged out of our shared experience and really the development of a sort of a digital culture. And for those who've not participated in that culture, they have no idea what those conventions are. So when you include them in your web design, your application design, you're basically throwing up sort of a cultural roadblock. So some of the things as examples would be navigation, you know, to Dean's point, things like the logo is the homepage. I'm going to click on the logo, it's going to take me back to the homepage. We know that, but that's completely hidden and mysterious to someone who's not culturally versant in the digital. The back button usage, you know, we've got quite a bit of sophistication and complexity around when you can use it, when you can't use it. People can really get lost. We've stopped using breadcrumbing as people try to get flatter navigation, which makes a lot of sense. But once again, folks are going to get lost there. What's clickable? How do we show a hyperlink? Making images clickable. The buttons, how are they labeled? I saw a site recently that I thought did a good job because its audience was probably not real accustomed to the conventions of the internet, and actually labeled their button Go. So I thought, you know, that because a lot of times we want to assume we want it to look snazzy and sexy and clean and mean, Really, in the end, anytime you think, well, everybody's going to know this, you've already gone down the wrong path. Good UI designers start from scratch and look at their who their target audience is. So just I would say to folks who are building web pages and apps, always check yourself when you start to think, well, everybody knows this, because if your audience is somebody who might not be as versant, then you're throwing up a barrier to them.
And I've heard you say design for mobile first when thinking of people now new to the internet. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, and I mean, this is a kind of a trend that people are talking about, but the beauty of the designing for mobile discipline is that you really have to focus in on what are those key functions that people are going to be doing in the geographical context or the context that they find themselves in as they're accessing your app, right? So you kind of get rid of some of your flash and some of your whiz-bang and you're cool and get real serious about the things that you want them to do or that they want to do. And there are a lot of UI experts that are talking about this as a really good way to get down to core discipline about usability. Design your mobile app first, and then from there, back up and build your web page. And it will lead to a much cleaner, more functional site. And this is just an example of a mobile application for one of our websites that we recently released with our vendor partner. And we thought it was kind of, at least the beginning of it's pretty clean. So we're trying to work on that as well.
Dee, are there any other countries that value rural broadband or have different models of deploying that you think we could learn from? I know you recently went to Australia.
Yeah. I mean, I think in this country, when we think of reaching out to unserved clients or audiences, we think of it more as consumers and not as earners. Australia is a good example. There's a country... Well, where the whole government, the last government elections, turned on the question of rural broadband, rural and regional broadband. And if you think about it, imagine a country the size of the continental United States with a population equal only to that of Texas. I imagine there's probably a lot of Texans who've already imagined that. But but you think about this big country and not that many... people, and they're in the middle of a $40 to $45 billion fiber build out to get to everywhere in the country. So they're not thinking about how do I get games and movies to people out in the boondocks. They're thinking about how can we position ourselves to be a leader, international, global leader in a digital economy. What do we have to do? What kind of infrastructure? And so whereas there's a fight over putting a few billion dollars into stimulus funds in this country to get to unserved audiences, their whole nation is turning on this huge commitment to the future. So I think that's a story that's worth watching from here.
I'd like each one of the members. Oh, did you have something?
Well, I think you had mentioned in a previous conversation to this sort of interesting perspective of, on the one hand, the idea of it as an entitlement that we're going to try and supply folks with this infrastructure versus this kind of infrastructure can have a fundamental impact on the economy in that in a place like Australia, geography becomes less of a barrier to economic growth.
Well, the promise of connectivity is really one of a different kind of citizenship. I mean, if you're disconnected, right, your kids are not going to be able to compete in the schools. You're not going to be able to get access to the healthcare technology that's the backbone of health reform. You're not going to be able to get the information you need to vote. And you're sure not going to be able to bring your goods and services to a world market. So if we want people in Indian country to really have a chance to compete in the next emergent economy, if we want people in And, you know, if we want hillbillies and people in inner cities and the people who are not connected to really participate, then we have to reimagine how we're connecting.
I'd like each of the panel members to give an example of where they saw the lack of broadband negatively impact someone's life, or conversely, where the introduction of broadband has positively impacted someone or the community as a whole. And I'll start with Dean.
Okay, last summer when I first started working with the UW Extension in Madison, we started working with the community members, and a lot of it was everyone was afraid to get online because of a lot of the stereotype, you know, the bad things out there. So I started to come up with a class that can help to teach how to be safe online. So majority of it was people were afraid of bad sites, afraid of viruses, and that really, really stopped a lot of people from coming in. And it was the language of the computer that stopped everybody else. So as we went through the summer, we really took it slow and basically just like sat around and, you know, would have coffee and kind of talk through these problems. And then soon after we talk about it, a lot of the members, you know, they started to understand more. They started to feel a lot better with understanding the technology. So,
Allison?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that folks are familiar with the examples. Like, I know a woman who was trying to go to college. She lived very, very rural. Just the cost of getting high-speed internet access was quite prohibitive for her. And, you know, she couldn't participate in one of her key classes because lessons and homework had to be done through the internet. And so that was a huge hurdle. But then on a kind of a larger scale, I moved from a urban environment, and so it was definitely came from the perspective of if you don't exist, you know, on the phone, then you don't exist at all. And so moving to a small town of about 15,000 people where is the Dairy Queen? Well, you take a left where that old church used to be, and I have no reference for what you're talking about because I just moved here. There isn't a representation of my town online, you know, either in a geographic, so on Google Maps with the businesses, that names for things have changed. You know, people use word of mouth to communicate about what's happening, and it's just not present at all. So I'm concerned about having this huge, vibrant dialogue where we're all, you know, increasing in our sophistication at exponential rates around what's going on and what's the buzz, and having these whole communities that aren't present in that discussion. So it's sort of like there's a, you know, there's a curtain, and there are these whole groups that are standing behind the curtain. And so that would be my answer to negative impact that I'm concerned about.
D?
Yeah, I think it's hard for us in this room to think that there are people still using dial-up. There was a great contest this past year in England where they had a contest between a passenger pigeon and dial-up to see who could deliver the message, and the pigeon beat it very badly. In my neighborhood, there are people trying to download homework lessons plans that have been on, you know, 19 hours to download. It's impossible. But we're also seeing a number of success stories in places like Three Lakes, Wisconsin. A community got together. They only had dial-up. They created a competition. They ended up kind of enticing different providers to come in, and all of a sudden they created a whole notion of getting people who came in for recreation, who came in for summer home, to think about moving there or spending four-day weekends there. And all of a sudden they've turned the economy of this little town around because they provided the kind of infrastructure capacity needed to do that work. And I think over and over again, what we used to think about churn rates and how we create economy and how dense the population and how what the critical mass was. It's all changed because if we can put that infrastructure together, then people can create their own wealth, and that's the opportunity we need.
Actually, that competition reminded me, Allison, about a great story you had about a tractor versus iPads.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of shook us up, too, when we heard it. So imagine like a retail store in a rural area, not that far from a metropolitan area, but biggest promotion of the year, they gave away a tractor. It was hugely, hugely popular. A couple years later, the iPad's been around. Well, we're going to give away 10 iPads. And amped and ramped to it, and in the end, they were only able to give away 7 of the 10. Because, and we realized, you know, that what's the iPad to me? Well, it represents, I have to learn new stuff, I'm going to have to pay for subscription or something, I mean, there's cost associated with it, I don't have this now, so, you know, tractor, there's something practical that I can use. iPad, this is just a burden, you know, and I'm not interested. It kind of reminds me of that line from the Pew Foundation, you know, where people say, well, there's nothing on the internet for me. It's this question of relevancy. That iPad was irrelevant to folks.
They should have given away carrier pigeons.
But I think it's just an example of where, you know, I was talking to some an agency that does Google Ads and SEM work, and they had the assumption that you could put some of these local businesses or services into, you know, pay-per-click ads on Google, and that this was going to result in sort of your standard conversion funnel that we all, you know, who've been in the business world understand and have seen. And I was trying to tell them, folks, they may see the ad, they might even click on it, but the subsequent steps that you and I might take as digitally versant people, you know, continuing through the funnel digitally, is not what's going to happen for them. They're going to click on that ad, and then they're going to take that information offline. And if there's conversion, it's going to be an offline conversion. So, you know, so the value of even pay-per-click messaging is the whole scenario is potentially different. You just can't assume that they're going to walk that same path.
And I think that one thing that would be of interest to the people in the audience is what does the digital divide matter to people on the connected side of the digital divide? Because most of the people in this room fall into that category. Dee?
Well, I guess in a way, think of what kind of model we want for our country. I mean, right now, the projections are that we're going to become 90% metropolitan in this country. We're going to only have about 8 urban areas where patents are being created, that all the wealth is going to be created in just a few places. And what does that mean about the other parts of the country? I mean, the country's in a pretty tough spot right now. Do we want to put the burden on a few places to create the wealth for the whole country, or do we want to be able to bring more people in to participate to lift the load? I think that's that. We were shooting a documentary a few years ago in a little town in South Dakota, Lake Preston, South Dakota. Their town was about to lose its drugstore. Then all that was going to mean is people have to drive 35 miles to get a prescription filled. It was going to, in some ways, hollow out the town, and they arranged to keep this drugstore alive. It's a small story. It's not that important, but at the time, the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle was there, and we interviewed him, and he said, the thing about small towns is everybody's needed. You're needed for the basketball team, you're needed for the band, you're needed for the PTA to be on the school board. Nobody's expendable. In a way, you can think about this economy right now. You can think about this country. Who's expendable? Who is it that we don't need to pitch in and make a difference? Instead of thinking of of creating an economy where a few people are going to lift the load, we can imagine an economy that where everybody can participate, where the way we sustain ourselves, the way we feed ourselves, the way we fuel ourselves is shouldered by a lot of people. And maybe it lets some of us who are out of the loop right now take a bigger role in helping move things forward.
I was going to ask if Dean had anything on that.
sorry, I missed the
Oh, about oh, yeah. What does it matter to people who are on the other, on the connected side of the digital divide?
Oh, for the well, in my community, the people that are already connected, we're learning a lot of the newer technology. You know, a lot of people are starting to get, you know, webcams, and they're starting to do more of the Skyping with the throughout the community. So with doing more things online now, there seems to be like the community is kind of growing as far as like being in contact with one another. Before the broadband cable and the fast internets were put in, I noticed that, you know, I didn't talk to too many of my friends. Now all of a sudden, you know, I'm talking to all my friends, and we're all really socializing through the different networks. And also the grandparents are being in contact with their grandchildren. And so I'm starting to see like a lot of the current existing users are just, you know, learning more, seem to be catching up with technology, and are really curious about, you know, purchasing more and new things. So,
Allison?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, I'm essentially very positive about the promise of the participation age. I do. I'm a believer. I have religion around it. And the definition, like if you go on Wikipedia and you look up tribe, there's an anthropological definition that's, you know, basically this is actually that one's not on Wikipedia. Postmodernists look at the anthropological definition that tribe is about kinship and geography. But tribes have been, you know, expanding and becoming, the people in citizenry have become more and more far-flung. So how do we keep our culture vibrant and alive? How do young Navajo that are, you know, in the military all over the world continue to stay grounded in their language and cultural traditions? There's just, I mean, the rate that Native American languages are dying out is terrifying. I mean, they're just gone, you know. I think we have maybe 70, it's less than 150 Native speakers left of the Chickasaw language. So I'm hopeful that that the promise of the participation age is going to allow for a lot more sharing and connection, community connection, when geography is an issue, you know. But I think most of the Chickasaw tribe live outside of the territory, and so to have access to things that remind people, or for the kids, you know, that don't know, have had very little exposure, I think that would be enormously valuable. And then to actually be able to talk back and forth, participate in events, I don't know. So that's my hope as someone on that divide. And there's a long way to go with the not just literacy, education, and access, but also figuring out what does it mean for this type of people with this type of culture. You know, being sensitive to that. It's not we've got a real sort of everything's transparent. Woohoo! Put it all up on the web, and we're going to talk about it. Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff. In Native tribes, people are very sensitive because there's a long history there of exploitation, right? You've got the whole, like, 70s and 80s sort of Native American spiritual events hosted by Northern Europeans, and folks who are very upset about that. So there are privacy things that tribes are going to have to figure out what's okay, you know, for us to talk about publicly. And it's a process, but I'm... I believe in the promise of it. I think it's going to help.
I have something for it with that. For a lot of our tribal members, if you request a username and password, you are able to log on to the native. It's like a native site, and then you can request a password so that you can go in and you can, you know, watch videos, look at text, hear audio, that can help teach you the language. So, but you have to be a tribal member to access that, because of, you know, you just don't want to just throw it out there for everybody. So some of the tribal members that maybe in the military, living off somewhere, you know, Florida or wherever, far away from wherever the tribe is, were able to go online, use their username and password, and then listen to some of the teachings for the language. And that way, you know, because I was in the military, you know, I was overseas and traveling around, and I was wanted to learn the language while I was away. And it's something that you don't forget about. You want to be able to learn your language and tell people that, you know, I can fairly well speak my language. So,
well, and you guys kind of scratched on it, and I'd love to hear from Dee on this a little bit, is concerns that you have about communities that are just getting online. What are your concerns about, you know, exploitation or...
I think that, you know, there's great responsibility that comes with change, and I'll change this cultural. These are powerful tools, and the tools can they can work in a benign way. They can teach. They can put light on problems. They can help us come together and create coalitions to make things better. And of course, they can also move us off the mark. They can, they can be about what's hip, or they don't necessarily have to move us in the right direction. So, I think it's important that that communities take these tools seriously. Not that they're always dangerous, but that we should try to put them in context with our history and our heritage, with who we are and where we want to go as a community. So when it's not so different from the more traditional media that we've used in the past. I mean, we can use them as background noise, or we can actually add value. We can learn how to not just be consumers, but be producers, and we can move that forward. And in some ways, that's the responsibility of the enlightened Jews.
Okay, Dean, up on the screen, it's the center that is under construction right now, and that you're working on getting put together. What are some of the ways you hope to use technology to preserve the Menominee culture? You talked about, you know, logging in and learning the language online. Are there other hopes that you have?
Yes, there's a lot of things for the Menominee and for the culture. One of the things that I can think about right now that I was kind of excited about was creating a like type of educational videos, doing projects with the youth and with some of the elders, so that you can create videos on like cooking. You know, what are some of the traditional cooking foods? Having the youth use the technology to record the traditional foods, and then, you know, saving those videos so that they can be distributed out to other members of the community that can learn in their homes, and that, you know, they might not be able to come into the center. You know, they might have a disability, or they might not be able to, you know, afford too much of the gas, or, you know, to drive around, or so. That's one of the things, right, is to preserve a lot of the different ways that might be dying out. Some of the other things that we're going to have in the center is rooms that you could come in, and getting contact with your loved one that might be, you know, in the military or just located in some other part of the United States. And there are media rooms that you can kind of keep that relationship with your family. There's also a number of classes that we're working with the elders, and the elders can come in, and it's usually like typing, and it kind of it'll be a center for all age ranges, and we'll have classes for the kids, some people that need help with filling out applications, you know, getting set up with email accounts. So it'll be kind of like a gathering, and it's a type of kind of bringing the community together in with help of the technology. So, you know, we see a lot of participation this summer. The center will be open from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 7 days a week, and a lot of the classes are free to the community members. So they can come in there, sign up for classes. They can come in and learn what it is they're looking to learn, and they'll be that much more closer to, you know, filling out applications online. So,
Allison, are there some hopes that you have for your community and broadband?
The main thing, we actually have released a Chickasaw language application, you know, so that folks can start to get familiar with the language. I mean, really, the Chickasaw are very far flung, we've talked about, you know, building libraries, cultural libraries online with videos. So that's what I'd like to see. I also, you know, we were on that Native America Calling radio show earlier this week, and Dean and I were, it was interesting to hear that we got a lot of calls from Alaskan Natives, and there was one gal who talked about, you know, their villages are quite far flung, but they created this online marketplace for the wares that they produce, and they could sell to one another and exchange with one another. It become this really vibrant commerce between the tribes and their individual villages, and she said it had just been quite successful. And looking at Twitter, I've been doing this for about 18 months, I think, trying to find natives from North America that are tweeting and see what they're using it for. And there are a lot of people out there that are, you know, they've got like a clothing line or a food line, or they're making music, or they're comedians, and they are using Twitter and the digital space to promote what they're doing, their entrepreneurial endeavors, and reaching out to one another. I think they're beginning to be effective, although the numbers are still really, really small. But that's I would like to see. I think it's a medium that's something that Native folks can leverage very effectively once they develop the literacy and the access.
Dee, is there anything you want to add about your hope for broadband?
No, I hope to get it. We work with a National Rural Broadband Coalition, and there are a number of strategies that we're advancing. There are a number of fights that we're engaged in. So there's a lot to be done. But my hope is that we can imagine it being a way to be more inclusive. That in some ways, you know, what I'm hoping for is that we can build an inclusive nation and this time get it right, that we can figure out strategies to include all the people and all the places, and so that we can work together. That's a broad approach, but the truth of it is, as a tool, it has a huge potential and a way to connect people, and I just hope we can concentrate on that and not get caught up in the divisiveness.
Okay.
I have a question.
Oh, sure.
Actually, for Dee, you know, one of the things that I'd read about is a lot of folks are have access to the internet in some of these areas, or their access is more likely to come through their mobile device and cellular networks than broadband. How do you see that kind of developing?
Well, it's certainly, you know, we're going through a big jump, and not just in the U.S. We're seeing it. I mean, in a world, it's in our bailiwick is rural, and so you know the you look at the world's population, half of it is rural, and many of those people are trying to struggle to keep their communities together and figure out whether they can stay in the countryside or if they're going to need to go to the city. So what's available in a lot of these places is rudimentary wireless, and so people are beginning to explore. Okay, we did a meeting on the use of technology and organizing in East Africa, and I was amazed at how many ways people were using cell phones. Like, you let it ring once means this, you let it ring twice. People had used all these systems so that they could kind of economize. And I think what we're seeing is as smartphones become more prevalent, we're seeing many people just not be able to, or not anticipating being able to afford high-speed broadband, and so they're looking to more wireless strategies.
Okay. Well, I was going to open it up for questions now.
Hi, my name is Anjali Shah. I'm a journalist. Thank you so much. This is so fascinating. It's opened so many new areas for me. I have two questions, one quick one, a little bit longer. One, Dee, you had mentioned that you were worried that lack of broadband access would prevent people from using the benefits of healthcare reform. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. And my other question is, you know, I know you mentioned about design that people can do to communicate and reach rural places. Is there anything else that somebody who, like me, I'm a journalist, I'm writing for a big general audience, is there something that we can do to reach communities that we're not necessarily a part of to kind of get more interest from those communities so then we can in turn do more reporting from those communities?
I'll try the first one, the healthcare question, and then we can see who wants to try to take a swipe at the next. The key to understanding health reform is that it's something that really works in suburban communities, that the whole plan is about changing the way that fees for services work so that we're not paying for every gallbladder that's taken out and for taking out the sponge that was left behind. Rather, we're paying to keep people healthy. And this really tends to work better in places where there's health management organizations, where the hospitals can begin to quickly change the way they are thinking about their patients, and there's a whole system of payments there. In small rural hospitals and distant places, part of what's driving the cost up is referrals, moving people around, and what the new technology allows is many more ways to monitor chronic illness, to get people connected to doctors and nurses. The travel cost oftentimes is a real price driver. And so it just gives us more ways to keep our communities healthy and to allow people who may have diabetes or may have other kinds of chronic conditions to live a way that we can focus on keeping them healthy in a more affordable way. I know that's a complex way of saying it, but the technology is critical to what we hope happens with the new healthcare law. And for those communities who are outside of that technology, they're going to have a harder time.
Okay, and Allison, did you want to take some of those tips for design?
Oh, yeah, actually, do you mind, whenever Dee starts talking, I'm just so fascinated, I'm going to lose my train of thought. Would you restate the question real quickly for me?
Sure. I mean, actually, the question was, your comments about design were very appreciated. Is there anything else that people like me who are writing for a general audience and publishing for a general audience online can do to reach rural and low-income communities better? Because I don't think we do it that well, to be frankly honest.
Oh, yeah. You know, and we had search up there on the list of things around assumptions, and it's not really a complete fit on that slide, but one of the things that I've noticed is, I'm sure you all have it, like, for me, my husband will try and look for something online and he can't find it, and then, like, I Google it, and boom, it's right there. This is a skill that you've developed, basically. You know, you've created a human-computer interaction. You figured out how the database works in some way, how to search for it. You know, I think one of my colleagues was talking about trying to get his mom to type in an effective Google search. And, of course, she's putting the whole sentence in there, and Google didn't quite like it. And so I don't know the answer to that one, but I would love to talk to some SEO experts just about... So when you've got something that's out there, making sure that those keywords, you know, the keywords that somebody in rural America is going to use to search, not someone who knows how to, you know, feels, who's on it for 6 hours a day, so that they can find it and finding ways to plug in. That's a complex. I'm not sure if I know the answer, but I think there's some issues.
Well, I'll say this: it's probably not. Exactly what an answer, but I mean, the reality is that what's happened in journalism is that daily newspapers that were serving every place in the state are pulling back. They're not delivering to rural areas. They don't have rural correspondents anymore. They're focused on the suburban core, and they're trying to deal with that market. As they pull back, it changes the political dynamic of rural areas. It changes. Look at the last election. It changes the political dynamic of the country. So what we end up having is a more bifurcated conversation, a more, you know, you leave the local church radio station to be the primary interpreter of national news. We end up creating different ways to get information and different information, even contradictory information. And so what happens in part of the big fight about extending these broadband services is once you get in there, then people get to select, they get a wider range of information. Then it's easier. I mean, I can tell you how to get your story there if somebody is online, but, you're not going to fax them something, right? So the platforms and the mechanics of getting those people are really different to wired communities and to communities that are disconnected.
Well, I'm going to throw out a little suggestion here, and that's partners. You know, the best way to you know, get people interested that you're writing about is to include them in the process if they're not writing it themselves. So if you're covering a group, reach out to those people in the community ahead of time and, you know, get those points that would be greatest to get the information out. You know, think about targeting those areas. You know, like one of the things we're going to do is we're going to put this up online in a podcast that native radio stations, if they want, they can download. You know, and they know that they can download our stuff and put it on their radio. And all the people in their communities, you know, don't have internet. They wouldn't be able to download the podcast, but they can turn on the radio. So, you know, that's a way to get the information. You know, look at those kind of partners, the person that has the internet within that community that you can reach out to that can then share it in another format. Other questions?
I was really interested in the concept of this sharing language online. Do you think there are other sort of cultural assets that might translate into digital services from the communities that are quote-unquote unconnected that might translate to the connected side and help sort of bridge that divide? I know it sounds like hippie culture, but is there something that comes to mind, even beyond language?
Well, there was other things we were thinking about doing, with language being one of them. Some of the other things was teaching, helping some of the members that live way out in the community how to get their product that they make. Because some of them sit home and they'll bead and they'll make dresses and they'll do these traditional costumes that they're gonna, you know, that's their only thing that they might know how to do, but it's a really good skill that they have. And sometimes we were figuring out how to get these, to get their products to be, you know, as a source of, to be sold as a source of income for their community members. So there's a lot of different things that we've been thinking about doing. The language has already been kind of rolling, and we're trying to work to better that system right now. So.
And I would add, an area that we've talked about and I think has a lot of potential and in a lot of ways is already going on in some spaces, is that, you know, the whole idea of storytelling. I mean, almost all Native American tribes have this, you know, still very vibrant cultural characteristic of storytelling. You know, you sit down and you hear these stories over and over again, they're translated. So how interesting and fun and just sort of invigorating could it be to take that storytelling and push it out into audio and video and various digital interpretations, and also kind of get the youth fired up again about some of these traditional stories that might not even be written down. You know, you just kind of, your grandmother said it a couple times, and so pumping the life back into that with youth and their access to the digital medium. It's one thought.
Are there other questions from the audience?
I have a question. Do I have to go up, or can I just...
If you could go up, that'd be great. That way it gets on the audio.
Okay, sorry. I'm curious to know if you have encountered any surprises, any kind of organic or different ways people are using the technology that you never intended, but was just surprising and kind of fascinating?
Yes, I have been surprised by a few people with the technology. And we started out with this person did not want to know anything. He's like, I just want to click one button and I want to be able to look at this, and that's all I want to do. And so then I was, you know, I'm saying, okay. So I arranged it that way. The next time I come back, there started to be more and more questions as time went on. So it's like one day I went over there and they got this, you know, Facebook account, or, you know, and then the next time I went over, now they're wanting me to hook up a camera. And the next thing I come back, they're like all excited, you know, I spoke with my grandkids, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, you're coming along really, really fast. You know, you're starting to learn, you know, at this you know, really fast rate. And, you know, that to me, that was really a shock for me to see how the potential of, like, you know, catching up, you know, for a lot of our tribal members, our community members, you know, you're just kind of sitting home and going to the store and coming back, you know. And but now with the technology, so a lot of the tribal members are starting to surprise, you know, by the things they're learning at the rate. And it's, everybody has this question mark or curiosity, you know, what is the computer? What is that? You know, and then as soon as they start learning how to use the computer, now they're able to use it to learn on their own. And once they're able to learn on their own, then they start to gather a lot of different knowledge on different things. So
it always makes me smile when Dean talks about using Skype, especially when he talks about the veterans, because a lot of people here probably don't know, but about a third of the Native Americans that are the age to be able to serve in the military. So in other words, you're talking about a huge chunk of this population that is over in Afghanistan, as Dean was, or over in Iraq, you know, and the way they can keep connected to their culture, the way they can keep connected to their family is through Skype. And it's a lot better way to do it than trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to call you on the phone at this time, blah, blah, blah. You know, it gives you a lot more options. So I think that's one great way that technology can be used within a rural Native community.
It was good to see the military also having the different Skype stations for their service members. So it makes it a lot easier when they connect with the family at home.
I just want to say, like, it's kind of tangential. It goes back to language. Sorry. just an anecdote. I had the opportunity to show some elders Twitter, and what I'd done is gone and asked that folks would tweet hello or greeting in their native language on Twitter, and so we pulled it up, and I was like, hey, how are you? You know, and then all these languages came back that were saying hello, and you could just see that they were really, wow, you know, that's amazing. And I think there's a site that it captures like endangered and indigenous languages that are being tweeted and who's tweeting them. I don't know. I don't have great words for it, but I think that's really, really powerful. You know, there's a sort of written record of live communication in a different language.
Well, I think that's about the end of the session here. Don't forget to fill out your survey about the panel in the feedback section of your South by Southwest app.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
I have some free Daily Yonder bandanas up there. I don't know what your plans are, but if anybody's planning on holding up a 7-Eleven, they come in really.
I got you.
And so let's keep the conversation going. We'll be tweeting out more information, some of the links we might have talked about, the link to the audio and the video, to the hashtag DGTLDIV. Feel free to contact us. You see our contact information up here. And then also, shameless plug as well, PBS Online Film Festival, where you can see, and this shows some of the importance of being able to get online, because these are stories that can't get onto broadcast, but they can get online, and so that we want them to be seen by not only our organization, the Native organization, but other minority consortia, including the Black Consortia and Pacific Islanders and Communications, the Latino Public Broadcasting, and also the Center for Asian American Media. So come up, and I have flyers that give you a little bit more information about that as well. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.